bunch of the rights to Bob Ross's videos were owned by a company who decided to just throw them up on Twitch, streaming all the time.
Maybe we'll have a little pink in the sky. I sort of like that.
It got massively popular. They had no idea it was going to happen, to the point that Bob Ross was eventually picked up by Netflix to stream all of their stuff, all because they started marathoning it on Twitch.
And in our world, we can do anything that we want to do here.
Later in the show, we'll learn all about Twitch, the online platform you go to watch people paint, play video games, and sometimes just go about their day. But first, USC is dealing with some serious fallout from a recent LA Times investigation exposing alleged abuse by a campus gynecologist. The Times reported that Dr. George Tyndall engaged in inappropriate behavior during exams at the Student Health Center, where he worked for nearly 30 years. Complaints from students and staff began in the early 90s, but USC didn't take action until 2 years ago, when Tyndall was allowed to quietly resign with a financial payout. Well, now some 200 USC professors are calling for University President Max Nikias to step down. They say Nikias has, quote, lost the moral authority to lead. Ariella Gross helped draft that letter. She's a professor of law and history at USC, and she joins us now. Hi.
Hi.
Well, tell us what prompted you to draft this letter and get some 200 professors to sign on.
So it really is something that built up over the past year, because this last episode is a part of a pattern, unfortunately, of serious wrongdoing and abuse that's taken place at USC that has been in which we've been very disappointed with the university's response. And when this last news broke and we found out that yet again the abuser was allowed to resign quietly with a secret payout and no reporting to the medical board, a group of faculty decided, you know, we can't keep silent about this. This administration has lost its moral leadership, and we need to stand up and say so.
And when you say a pattern, are you referring to the earlier report about the former medical school dean, Dr. Carmen Pugliafito? And then his replacement?
Yeah. Yes, two USC medical school deans in a row, in fact.
Yeah. Well, here is Nikias's response, which he sent to us. USC wouldn't make anyone available to us on air. But he says, I understand the faculty's anger and frustration. I've always encouraged our faculty to express their views and opinions on issues of critical importance. They are core to the mission of this university, and I am grateful for their contributions to the action plan we released today. I'm committed to working with them as we implement this wide-reaching plan and to rebuilding their trust. We all deeply care about this university, and we all need to work together to change the culture. First of all, have you seen this action plan? It's about 20 pages long. And second, what's your response to his response?
So I've seen it. I can't say I've read it carefully because it is very long. I have two basic responses. One is that as I said, this president and this administration has lost the trust and the moral leadership that is required to have an action plan, to do the things that need to be done next. We believe, the signers of the letter believe, that this president has to step aside and allow new leaders to take the necessary steps to repair this damage. My brief look at the action plan suggests that it creates some new layers of bureaucracy. It's possible that these new, that it has good ideas in it. I'm certain that's possible. But the bottom line is that someone has to take responsibility from the top, and we have not seen that. President Nikias's response to us, to the university community, was as though he were a bystander, like you. I'm horrified by this news, as though he doesn't bear responsibility as the leader of the university.
Mm-hmm.
The buck stops there. I mean, that's corny, but that's true.
Well, I guess the trustees still support him, though. They have sent out a statement that says, you know, while they too are horrified by all of this, they have full confidence in his leadership, ethics, and values, and they are certain he will successfully guide the community forward. That's from this letter from John Mork, chairman of the USC Board of Trustees. So if he hasn't lost the faith of the trustees, what do you make of that?
We were very disappointed in the letter that was released by the executive committee of the board. It wasn't clear to us whether this letter was sent before they received ours or after. We certainly hope that after they consider the message that is coming from students, and I understand also, I'm sorry, from the faculty, and I understand also from students and alumni, that they will reconsider and that the entire board, not only the executive committee, will meet and think about this. I also think that President Nikias, we hope that President Nikias will think hard and do the right thing in offering his resignation and allowing the university to move forward.
All right. I want to thank you so much for joining us today.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having me.
That's Ariella Gross. She's a professor of law and history at USC. Well, all this news about the way USC handled reports of abuse by a university gynecologist surfaced because of an investigation from the LA Times. Matt Hamilton is one of the reporters on that investigation. Welcome.
Thank you, Madeline. Thanks for having me.
All right. So what do you think is going to happen? You've got this letter from the professors published in your paper. You've got the response from Nikias, and you have this other statement from the Board of Trustees. Does Nikias survive?
Not for me to say. I mean, we're chronicling the back and forth and the updates from faculty, from administrators, and from trustees. It's all happening very rapidly. We have no indication either way, except that the trustees' statement that you referred to, they expressed full confidence in USC's president, and it remains to be seen if that will change.
Well, I guess my question is, why do they have full confidence? And perhaps I could only ask them that question, because as we just were discussing, this is not the first time that a very shocking scandal has rocked USC, and not the first time in the last year.
It's not the first time, you're correct. And we have certainly made concerted efforts to reach out to all 59 trustees over the past year since the first medical school scandal that we broke, Dr. Carmen Pagliafito, and few trustees have been willing to speak on the record. Actually, none have except the chairman, John Mork.
Mm-hmm. And is, you know, not to be too cynical about this, but is this a money issue in the sense that do they trust Nikias to bring in a lot of money into the university?
Well, President Nikias has been a very prolific fundraiser, a very successful one. They recently completed a $6 billion capital campaign that continues today. So, you know, by the numbers, President Nikias has been tremendously successful as a fundraiser, and many people say that's not to be disputed. And that could be a reason why the board is so confident in President Nikias. They just have offered very few reasons to explain why they're arriving at this conclusion today.
A lot of money comes from China and from Chinese students, and the report on Dr. Tyndall's abuse, your story says that some of it was directed to students from China because they weren't familiar with American gynecological exams. They had never had one before, and so perhaps he saw them as easy targets. There were three Chinese students in the last few years have been murdered on or near the campus. I'm just wondering, USC does have a lot of Chinese students. What is the reaction from the Chinese community and from Chinese investors in the university?
The reaction among the Chinese student community and the international student community has been tremendous. I mean, this story has really taken off in China. China's state-run television network interviewed me, last week, and the consulate, the Chinese consulate, released a very pointed statement last week expressing deep concerns for an investigation, and just very communicating a sense of outrage over what's happened. The students, you know, USC has said there's no indication that Dr. Tindall targeted one particular group over another. But our reporting showed that, you know, many of the people who witnessed these exams, the clinical staff at USC's Student Health Center, really felt that he had trained his attention on these international students, particularly from China, who, you know, as you said, may not have been familiar with gynecological exams in the U.S., and also may have, you know, limited English skills to understand some of the remarks he may have been saying.
All right. And then in terms of the broader campus community, I imagine that there's a lot of soul searching and shock and anger just on the part of the student body. And obviously, we just heard from a member of the faculty. That's the same feeling there.
Tremendous sense of disillusionment, anger, shame, just wondering how this could have happened for so long. There's a petition online that was started by a prominent recent alumna, Rini Sampath. She's a former student body president, and that petition is calling for President Nikias to be fired. So there's really a, on social media, in these communications among alumni, they're really just outraged, and they're frustrated, I think, by this seemingly regular sequence of scandal that's partly uncovered by our reporting, and frustrated by that.
And you have also the lawsuits filed by six women against the university.
Yes. Yesterday, a total of six women filed three lawsuits against USC and Dr. Tindall. And today, I believe Gloria Allred is representing another former patient who has filed a lawsuit against the university. So, you know, we've been in touch with some of the lawyers who are representing former patients, and they say there are more lawsuits coming. They wouldn't be surprised if by the end of the week it's in the several dozens. But, you know, we'll see what's filed. But that's certainly a factor given the potential for costly financial settlements that will probably be paid for by insurance, but really could put a toll on the university.
Yeah, and keeping this story in the news, something the university, I'm sure, does not want. Matt Hamilton, Metro reporter for the Los Angeles Times, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you, Madeline.
Coming up, the writer Sloane Crosley is back with a new essay collection. She's here next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Author Sloane Crosley shot to literary fame 10 years ago with her debut book of essays, I Was Told There'd Be Cake. Her dry humor and self-deprecating style of storytelling made the book a bestseller and drew comparisons to David Sedaris and Sarah Vowell. She was even a finalist for the Thurber Prize, which honors American comedy writing. Crosley is now back with her third book of essays. It's called Look Alive Out There, and in it, she employs the same wit and biting observation skills that are characteristic of her work, but with a little bit more maturity this time around. And Sloane Crosley joins us now. Hi.
Hi. Well, thank you. I was about to say welcome to you, but I'm here. Hi.
Hi. Well, I don't know if maturity is necessarily the right word, but I guess you're older this time, 10 years older. And it just feels
more
like
of a technicality than an adjective.
It feels like you have maybe a little bit more, I don't know, wisdom into your life and its, how should I put this delicately? The fact that it doesn't last forever. Mortality?
What, my life? Yeah, I don't know if my sensibility has changed that much. I think that's sort of the potential farce of promoting this book. I think it's actually the subjects that have just, you know, gotten more serious or more mature or more layered.
Yeah. So what are the subjects that you're most interested in now?
I am progressively interested in general in making darker things funny. That seems to be where my writing is going, at least with the narrative nonfiction. But there's an essay about appearing on Gossip Girl briefly as myself, but it's really an essay about identity, which is a larger subject. There's an essay about writing about loneliness, death, getting sick, my porn star uncle, fertility. I mean, all these things sound like they could either be very funny or very serious and depressing, depending on what the prism is. And my prism is generally funny.
Let's talk about this trip you took to Ecuador.
And okay.
You decide to
Let's
climb.
Do it.
Let's just go there. You decide to climb the country's second highest peak. There.
Yeah, I mean, while we're giving me credit for things, it's an active volcano.
Okay, just sure. So you know what's happening in Hawaii. You know it intimately.
Yeah, not that active.
Okay, technically.
I'm not putting it in the ring with what's going on in Hawaii.
Okay, so you're not fleeing from raging lava flows.
No.
But you weren't exactly an experienced hiker before embarking on this, correct?
No, the reverse. I mean, in fact, the tallest mountain I'd probably climbed was a mountain called Mount Monadnock in New Hampshire, which last I checked was North America's most frequently climbed peak, and peak is sort of a big word for it. I mean, I used to play freeze tag on the summit as a kid, so that's a little bit different than Cotopaxi, which required crampons and not getting altitude sickness. And I made it to about 17,000 feet. The essay becomes not just sort of a fun cocktail party story about the time I, you know, got severe altitude sickness and started seeing things in a foreign country. It was really more about the weight of inexperience and trying to figure out in any given scenario how much is what you don't know and what's sort of the difficulty of the task, and how sort of loneliness was really one of the elements, because I did this by myself, and realizing that's a real killer, is not being able to speak the language and doing it on your own.
Because you had a guide or a couple of guides, but they didn't speak English.
I had one guide.
And his assistant.
He didn't speak English. His assistant. Yeah, I call him his assistant. Or he referred to this guy as his assistant, this man who just sort of appeared in the car with me the next day. And I was like, great. I am in no mood to be kidnapped. And also, I don't have the money for it. which, incidentally, just before, is something I would think in any country on this planet.
Right.
It has nothing to do with the fact that it was in South America. But I have developed this sort of hard-forged bond with this guy, because there's nothing that we can do except for depend on each other, even though we don't like each other. And that's where part of the sort of perverse buddy comedy comes into play.
Well, did you know going into it how harrowing it would possibly be?
No, because I did a really stupid thing. And, you know, in these essays in general, I hopefully don't shy away from my own stupidity and my own flaws. And one of the flaws in this case was that I couldn't be bothered to Google the mountain. And if I had, if you go ahead and Google Cotopaxi right now, I never would have climbed it. I thought I could climb it in sort of leggings and, you know, maybe some layers, maybe a nice fleece.
Yeah, I just did Google it, and it's every single picture is of a lot of snow. And
a lot of snow. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
There's you have to climb it very, very early so that the sun doesn't melt and glacier and, you know, avalanche triggers don't mess you up depending on the timing, which is not really something that I had to do when I was climbing mountains in New Hampshire as a kid.
Okay, so you think that you're just going to climb a regular old mountain. You didn't think there was going to be snow, so you didn't have the right equipment. You certainly didn't have crampons.
I had nothing. No sleeping bag. One had to be lent to me. But no, I did not have any of the technical gear that I needed.
So your guide, he kind of gives you some gear, but he seems a little pissed off or He seems a little angry that you...
He's annoyed at me because I keep asking questions.
But also that you came
such
unprepared.
Such as, am I going to die?
Yeah.
You know, these nitpicky kind of things. Well, yeah, I mean, it was a sort of mutually assured destruction in the fact that I didn't ask enough basic questions before meeting him, and he didn't give me enough answers after meeting him. So we were both pretty annoyed at each other. But I felt very strongly that... as ill-prepared as I was and as, you know, stupid as my questions were, I win because I'm the one who's about to get altitude sickness. So my annoyance trumps his. He's just sort of annoyed that he has to take a stupid American tourist up a mountain.
Right. So then,
I'm annoyed that I'm about to get 103-degree fever. These are different.
Right. And so you don't make it. You come down because you get too sick.
No, I don't make it. I tried. I really tried. Gave it the old college try.
So I guess what do we learn from that? Or what did you learn?
What do
from
we learn?
What is our takeaway from what you did?
A lot of the takeaway is not about the mountain. It's not about the bike, Madeline. No, I'm kidding. It's not. It's really just. It's about the drugs that I took. Just kidding. It was just malaria pills.
I mean, do you see yourself as as someone who takes risks, an adventurer?
Yes, but only it's so funny. Part of the point of this specific essay is how that's a travel thing for me. You know, at home, I'll walk by a restaurant, you know, that's two blocks away from my house and think I should order out from there later. I'm so profoundly lazy at home. But, you know, all you have to do is get me just slightly out of my comfort zone and that sort of youthful. And when I say youthful, I really mean like almost childlike curiosity kicks in. And a lot of these essays have that in them. And I would say that Up the Down Volcano is certainly like the prime example of that.
I guess I felt reading it, too, when you're talking about like what can be learned from these from this particular essay is that it really was kind of a humbling experience for you, or it seemed like it was. Like here you were thinking you were invincible, going out to do a travel piece, and you just have this this sort of fun adventure. And then you came face to face with some real difficulties, and you got really, really sick. And like you said, you experienced crushing loneliness and an inability to communicate with a guy who really had your survival in his hands.
I mean, my entire life is... you know, outside, off the page is about coming face to face with my limitations.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's, you know, in all of these essays, there is a little bit of that. And I think I use that maybe in lieu of wrapping things up nicely. You know, there's a way that you can write an essay where there's an image that starts it and then you have a little adventure and whoops, there's an image that ends it. And I'm very wary of that format. It's just a little too neat, a little too, you know, what I learned. Because I don't think you necessarily learn something from every experience. And I don't know where that came from, this idea that in order for a humor essay specifically to sing for its supper, we have to learn something. I think you have to be amused. I think you have to be educated in some way. I think it has to chime in with your own life, and you can sort of, readers can have this sort of tapas experience of taking what they want from it. But similarly, all of it's like that, you know? I mean, I interview my uncle, who was a big porn star in the 70s in San Francisco and L.A., and what makes that interesting, aside from the sort of boogie nights aspect, is that he got into pornography to find a girlfriend, to find love. That's what makes the essay slightly different. And so I go to him for romantic advice, and the advice ends up being very true and very meaningful, but not particularly original.
So what was his advice?
Johnny's?
Yeah.
His name is Johnny. I mean, his advice had a sort of a Didion-esque quality to it where, you know, there's a bit in Goodbye to All That where she talks about how every late night and every, you know, avoidance and every procrastination, it had all counted. And there's basically his advice was that, you know, if you're going after certain kinds of relationships, you don't just sort of magically outgrow who you are one day, which is... something I think that happens to people who haven't really committed to a relationship. It's not my particular problem, but I see it in a lot of friends where they just sort of assume, especially guy friends, actually, that one day, you know, there's this life with this wife and kids or a partner and kids, but none of their behaviors sort of align with that, and they're getting older and it all counts. Mm. And so it's very sad in that way, but Johnny phrased it in a more hopeful way than that in the essay.
You don't outgrow who you are, meaning
no.
You are
no matter where you go, there you are. Exactly.
Did he ever find love, Johnny?
Johnny, not really. I mean, that's the thing. And again, I'm making these essays sound like a big bummer. but then again, I already have the baseline of interviewing my porn star uncle, whose actual name is Johnny Seaman. So there's only so far I could deviate from the humor of it. But
that
no,
is not his actual name.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. It is. Yeah. So Johnny runs a singles group at his local temple. He's not unhappy, though. I mean, that's the thing, is that I think it's lovely to meet somebody who's, you know, in their 70s and still considers himself a work in progress. Like the not figuring out who you are right now, the opposite of that is not tragedy.
Yeah.
It's just might not get you exactly everything you think you want right now.
So are you always looking for something, for material? Are you do you look at your life now?
Am I a narc?
As a short yeah, as a series of possible short stories or short essays?
No, I don't. I think I would be intolerable. I will say there is a comforting thing that I think to myself personally, which is that in a way there's no such thing as a truly bad experience anymore, because either something passes without incident or I can write about it. But I absolutely do not look out for it and think this would make a good essay, unless I am on assignment from a magazine to, you know, go play in traffic, in which case, yes, I do. But no, I absolutely do not do that. I think it would drive me nuts. I do think this stuff does tend to happen to me. But it's not really about the stories. I mean, all of these, if you strip away their meaning, all these essays, and there are 16 of them, I mean, I feel like they would just hopefully make decent stories and decent cocktail party conversation or, you know, oh, that's so funny. But I don't, yeah, that extra layer doesn't come with the experience. That extra layer comes with perspective and a sort of comic sensibility, and that you don't need to leave your house at all for. So no, I don't intentionally do this stuff unless I'm already out and about and there's a dark alley to fling myself into, then I'll do that.
The book is called Look Alive Out There. It's by Sloane Crosley. Sloane, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up, watching other people do things in real life. The streaming platform Twitch is gaining traction beyond gamers.
In my free time at night, I was alone, and I had watched streamers before, and I started it as a hobby. I never thought that it would be my full-time job.
The world of streamers, next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Until recently, the website Twitch was known mostly to gamers. Well, now it's becoming more mainstream. It has 15 million active users every day. And they don't only watch other people play video games. They also watch other people making art, working out, wrestling. Twitch just hosted a 48-hour marathon of SNL leading up to its finale last Saturday. And Amazon, which owns Twitch, runs its TV pilots on the platform. Stephen Asarch is a reporter for Newsweek, and he writes about video games, which means he writes a lot about Twitch. I guess you're on Twitch a lot, Stephen.
Oh, yeah, every night. It's my television.
Okay, it's your television, and it turns out to be a lot of people's television. So talk about how it went from basically a site where people watched other people playing video games to what is it now?
Well, Twitch.tv started out as Justin.tv a few years ago. It was these two college guys who got together and wanted to create a reality show about one of their lives and put it online. No one actually watched much of their reality show, but the technology they created allowed others to live stream and also video chat, something that really wasn't there before. So they put out the technology to the world, and slowly, over time, gamers started to really, like, grasp onto this stuff. It's only ballooned since then. The amount of viewers has gone up through the roof. It's just become a massive success that now everyone wants to know about.
In, like, a year?
No, it's been quite a long journey. But everyone's finding out about it now because of how popular it's gotten. But Twitch has always been a fairly popular platform. You know, 4 or 5 years ago, you could still pull in 10,000 viewers off of a stream of somebody no one else would know about. But over the past year, with the popularity of Fortnite and other Battle Royale genre games, it's really, you know, blown up to a whole new level.
Right. So Fortnite is hugely popular.
Yes. Fortnite is pretty much broken the standard for video games. Because this game is free to play and available on every console, PC, and can be played on iPhone, it's blown up to a level that wasn't available before.
Okay, I want to play a clip of tape from a Twitch streamer, and that's what you call them, right? Streamers?
Yes.
Okay. And she's from Long Beach. Her username is Haley Adesudo, and she's a gamer. She plays Fortnite. She's also an artist, and this is her talking about this is her full-time job.
In my free time at night, I was alone, and I had watched streamers before, and I started it as a hobby. I never thought that it would be my full-time job. I'll tell you, it was one of the scariest things I've ever done in my entire life. Like, I had my career lined up for me. I figured that's one thing I'd be doing for the rest of my life, but I was sitting at 250 subscribers, and I was averaging a decent amount of viewers. I had gotten sponsored by an esports team, Energy. And so between that and my subscribers, I had decided that I needed to be able to put in the hours and the grind to make this my full-time job. And so I put in my 2 weeks, and I just started streaming.
Okay, so how do streamers make money? I guess through sponsorship?
Not exactly through sponsorships. Twitch streamers have a few ways to make money. First are subscriptions, which are on the platform. You can pay $5 a month to get special access to streamer emoticons in chat, and up to like half to a little bit more goes directly to the streamer. Now, when Twitch partnered with Amazon, they created a program called Twitch Prime, which gives you a free subscription each month to your favorite streamer. So you can give your favorite streamer more money if you choose to. There's also donations, which streamers regularly get from their fans. There's also sponsorships from bigger companies. But the lion's share of the revenue from a Twitch streamer comes from subscriptions and donations.
Okay, tell me about this streamer named Ninja who played...
I can do that. Every day at work, all day.
What, you followed Ninja?
Oh, I follow Ninja straight from the top. So Ninja, full name Tyler Blevins, I swear I could be his biographer at this point, he used to be a Halo pro player, and he's been streaming since pretty much streaming was around. He started with other games like H1Z1, but when Fortnite came around, he jumped on it hard. Now Ninja can pull in 200,000 people on a regular night just playing the game.
I guess you're one of them. What is it? What's so great about Ninja?
Ninja is just really good at the game. I think that's the reason he's gotten so popular. He can like kill 30 people without blinking an eye. He's also incredibly fun to watch.
And he played Drake recently. He played Fortnite with Drake, right?
Yes. So that's the moment that everything changed, at least in my opinion. And my bosses started emailing me saying, hey, what's this Twitch thing? So Ninja, I think Drake direct messaged him. So they just jumped into a lobby together. and they just played Fortnite. There was really nothing unique about this stream in any way, shape, or form. But the fact it was a traditional celebrity playing alongside a Twitch celebrity broke a barrier that wasn't that normally doesn't get
like
to be broken.
Like a sound barrier or something?
It's pretty much
like
that.
Dogs howling.
You could hear it in the background. For so long, gamers have been the marginalized group. They've never been the ones in charge. And now that gaming has become the giant space that it is today, we're a part of the normal sphere. And it's still like hard for us to get used to it. But with more things like Ninja getting more popular and playing with more people, and you know, traditional celebrities getting into esports, it's normalized.
Mm. Okay, but it is online, so that must mean that there's a dark, horrible side to it.
Oh, yeah. We got weird things on Twitch. Twitch is much better than a lot of companies at policing their own social media because they are owned by Amazon and everyone has their eyes on them. They're very, very, very quick to ban streamers for doing inappropriate things. The problem is streamers keep doing inappropriate things. We've had some of the largest streamers in the world, Ninja and PewDiePie are the two biggest, that have slipped out and said the N-word. You know, you're streaming for 12 hours a day, and they slip out the N-word.
And then what happens when that happens?
Twitch bans them. So Twitch has a ban system where, depending on how many times they have a strike system. So say it's your first offense, you could get banned for a day. Second offense could be 7 days to 30 days. And by your third offense, they'll just take away your channel. It's a way to try and police some of this stuff. But some streamers have built a career out of being risque. So they're worried about what they're allowed to say on the platform and what they're not. Twitch is very, very strict in what they allow. And they're not very good at describing what they want these streamers to do.
Interesting. So what are the more popular ones besides gaming?
Gaming is still number one. The close second would be IRL, which means in real life. A regular person, they're not playing at that point, can take their phone or another camera and like walk outside in the real world.
What?
It's weird when you think about it, but you're watching someone else live their life. Imagine you're someone else at home who really doesn't get out much or doesn't see a big city. And now you're watching someone go to another country, like interact with other people, and you might be too scared to do it. You're getting to egg them on because you can talk to them in chat or through donations. It creates this, it's a whole weird network of people that don't normally interact that are doing it now.
So the IRL person goes outside, is walking around, and then he or she is wearing a headset and hears comments? Or how does he or she interact in real time?
Yeah.
So
Twitch, I should describe what Twitch chat is. Twitch chat is a chat room where people can write messages. There are emoticons that mean certain things. So the average IRL streamer also has a cell phone in front of them reading Twitch chat so they can interact with the hive mind in real time.
It would seem a lot to juggle, literally, in your hand, and then you're out in the world interacting, but you're also filming, but you're also interacting with the people who are emoticoning you. It's a lot.
I've met a lot of Twitch streamers who you become a separate person when you're streaming on Twitch because you're aware of all those people in front of you. You know, there's an audience there. You can't act like you normally would.
Yeah.
And trying to like balance everything and a lot of them, like, their full-time job is streaming. So say if you're not an IRL streamer and you're a gaming streamer who sits in front of their computer all day, you're not really interacting with any actual human beings. You're just interacting with a chat box. And it creates, like, this sort of introverted person that it can be difficult to you know, interact with people in the real world. I've met plenty of streamers who are the exact opposite and are the most normal human beings on the planet. But I've also interacted with streamers that I don't think they've ever left their bedroom before.
But I guess, would you rather be the streamer? At least you're doing something than sitting in your bedroom all day and watching the streamer. Not doing
anything.
Oh,
yeah, without a doubt.
I mean,
yeah, I'd rather make a lot of money.
Yeah. What are the demographics? Age, sex?
So it's mainly male. Shocking. But they're in terms of like demo on Twitch on the viewers, it can range quite a lot depending on the content. Ninja, his viewers tend to skew on the younger side of things, the preteens to early teens who enjoy that sort of content and are talking about Fortnite at school. Mm-hmm. But other streamers, there some of them can be, you know, 30 plus, you know. There are streamers who paint miniatures or play Dungeons and Dragons or paint or do tons of other stuff, and their audiences can tend to skew on the higher side of things. Twitch is such a massive platform at this point, it's really impossible to just like pigeonhole just one direct audience.
So maybe Bob Ross was an early pioneer of this kind
of thing. Bob Ross, actually, the reason he's popular again is because of Twitch. So
really?
here's my little – yes. So Bob Ross, a bunch of the rights to Bob Ross's videos were owned by a company who decided to just throw them up on Twitch streaming all the time. It got massively popular. They had no idea it was going to happen, to the point that Bob Ross was eventually picked up by Netflix to stream all of their stuff, all because they started marathoning it on Twitch.
Oh, my gosh. You're kidding, because I was watching it on Netflix. Little did I know.
That's how it got there.
And I could see the appeal. I was addicted.
Yeah, you leave it on in the background. Twitch has done plenty
foreground.
Of like
I was fully watching it. I couldn't take my eyes off him.
Yeah, it's become like I went to TwitchCon this year, and at TwitchCon they had like a Bob Ross like booth was set up selling Bob Ross merchandise because Bob Ross is a Twitch streamer.
Wow, may he rest in peace. Well, Stephen, thank you. Thank you for that.
Thanks for having me.
Tutorial. Stephen A. Sartz, reporter for Newsweek, where he writes about Twitch and other things video. Thanks, Stephen.
Thank you.
Coming up, why salt shakers are missing from restaurant tables these days. It's hard-hitting news coming up next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, shake it if you can find one. Have you noticed when you go out to a nice restaurant these days, something's missing from your table? Kate Crater did. She's a food editor for Bloomberg News, and she looked into why salt shakers are MIA. Hi.
Hi.
Well, chefs do seem to take their salt very seriously these days. I'm just going to play a clip to illustrate that.
You guys cannot even decide what truffle flavor tastes like unless you put salt in it.
I did put salt in it.
You did not put any salt in it. You can't tell me you're making it.
No, I put salt in
there. There is no salt in here.
I put a little in there. I'm not.
It's not seasoned.
Okay, that's an interaction between a contestant and celebrity chef Joe Bastianich on MasterChef. But it does illustrate that chefs are the ones who are supposed to be salting the dishes, right? They don't like customers salting their food. Is that why there are no more salt shakers on tables these days?
That is one reason why there's no more salt shakers. Chefs definitely like to be in charge. They are the boss, and they've been, as you can see, they've been on Top Chef. They've been in so many places where they are the king, and they think they should decide the seasoning in your food.
And so because we're all a bunch of foodies now, and chefs are now celebrities, we've basically acceded to their demands?
Well, I think it's been sort of a knowing transition. You don't realize it. It's also, there's been such a boom in high-flavored foods here in New York. Mamafuku, which is this fantastic Korean restaurant, does these big, bold flavors, as do places like Mission Chinese Food that have these explosive chicken wings. So if you can even see through all the heat to think about salt, then you're operating on a very high level. So
yeah. Well, also, it seems like we don't really like that old boring salt shaker. Like, we're grinding our salt now, even in our homes. I mean, you can get, like, Himalayan pink sea salt at Trader Joe's.
Exactly. You need the array of colors on salts is like a rainbow, and it gives you bragging rights. And so now if you see one of those little old school salt shakers, you should actually hold your nose and say, oh, is that the best you can do? It's really I don't know if you've tasted it recently, but it's nasty. It's really harsh, and it actually ruins food instead of helping it.
Oh, okay. So you're on board with this, getting rid of them.
I'm on board with getting rid of those old salt shakers, but I think someone's going to make $1 billion on Shark Tank when they figure out the next iteration of them, like a really cool salt shaker that works in different dining rooms, because so many dining rooms are highly designed now, and they require a certain aesthetic, you know, a certain look for your salt shaker. So the, you know, grinding, some places have salt grinders that look really cool if you're in like a Scandinavian place, but that doesn't work if you're in like a retro Brooklyn, you know, reclaimed wood place.
Yeah, where you're supposed to put your finger in a bowl and put it on.
Exactly. And then, but then, you know, you want to make sure that salt is fresh, because if someone else just put their finger in that bowl, that's gross.
That is gross and yuck. Okay. Also, can I just rant a little bit about the tyranny of... good fellow ranter. The tyranny of the small plates in the sharing menu and the fact that our tables are now covered with plates, and so there's no room for the salt shaker.
There is not 1 inch of space on tables now for a salt shaker, even if you had the most attractive one. It's true between like sharing between small plates and large platters and 5 wine glasses. Good luck trying to find some room with all those small plates you've got piled up.
What about pepper? Is that next to go?
That's a really good question. That could be the next story. I think people prize pepper. And there's also that whole, like, you know, that whole theatrical shebang with someone coming over with a giant pepper shaker.
Yeah.
I don't even know what that means anymore. Pepper could be next. What a question.
Well, tell us about this guy, Salt Bae.
Salt Bae. Well, that's the thing. It should be a really big time for Salt New York, because this Turkish chef, whose actual name is Nusret Gökay, and he's a butcher, and he has a chain of restaurants called Nusret, and what opened in New York this year, and it's been the hugest opening. It's in Midtown. It's got these steaks that are crazy priced. They're priced in like the hundreds of dollars, but people have gone crazy for it. But the big appeal is that this guy is this internet meme. He has like 13 million followers on Instagram. He has this theatrical way of seasoning steaks with salt. Like, he sort of like arches his arm and it sprinkles down on the plate down his arm. The health department shut him down because there were some health issues with him using
The salt on his arm? It wasn't sanitary?
First, he was just doing it with his bare hands, which is really exciting. And then the health department was said, no way. And so we had to start wearing gloves, and that looks really weird, but a little bit like Michael Jackson. So
because they're black gloves. Yeah.
Black gloves. He knows the power of a black glove. But you can't even imagine how many cell phones come out when he walks around the dining room and sprinkles salt. And so it seems like we should be taking our salt very seriously, and yet it's disappeared.
Exactly. Well, also, people are concerned about their health, and salt is associated with high blood pressure.
You know, I don't want to underestimate that, and it's true. People should be careful of their salt. They shouldn't just be, like, grabbing salt shakers and going crazy. But in a lot of places, sugar has kind of become public enemy number one. That's what people are paying more attention to and calling for labels on packages. So salt's sort of been, like, skating under the radar a little bit.
Well, I know, so under the radar, we can't get it anymore in restaurants.
Exactly. It's gone way under the radar.
Kate Crater, food editor for Bloomberg News. Thank you.
Madeline, so nice to talk to you.
Okay, let's talk to that salty dog, Christian Bordahl.
Hey there, Madeline.
Hi.
It's a momentous day for KCRW Press Play.
Tell us.
We are live streaming on Twitch.
I know, right this minute.
Twitch TV,
so
right
go
this
on
minute.
Twitch
to anyone who's on Twitch.
See us. How do you do that?
Twitch.tv/KCRW.
KCRW Radio.
KCRW Radio, that's it. Yep. Yeah. Exactly. And then you would be seeing us right now. You wouldn't just be listening, you would be actually watching the two of us on air as we talk.
It's too exciting. Really.
Well, I was watching a little IRL on Twitch today. Because it's kind of fascinating, the in real life stuff.
Yeah.
I was watching two guys fishing. with 3,000 other people. I was watching a woman building some very elaborate armor, apparently for cosplay, for like with another 580 people. There was a lot of music out there. In fact, this Bavarian-looking gentleman was singing a little bit to his listeners. He was wearing this kind of medieval Bavarian-looking garb.
Wow. Interesting. That, was it? Could you take your not take your eyes off it? Was it so riveting?
That one, I didn't stick around for very long. I just thought it was worth playing a little bite of
you
it.
You know, we have 20 viewers right now. 24.
20? 24. Wow. It keeps growing. I think we must be doing a good job.
Maybe we should start singing a Bavarian drinking song. Uh-huh. That maybe up our numbers a little bit.
I did do a little Twitter poll to see who amongst our listeners does in fact Twitch. And I got 12% saying that they love Twitch. They're on it like more than 10 hours a week. 22% said they're on it sometimes, less than 10 hours. 28% said they're not into it, don't do Twitch. And 38% said, what's a Twitch?
How many said, what's a Twitch?
38%.
That was us.
That was us a few days
ago. Until now, and now we're experts.
Just like Benjamin Gottlieb, our KCLW compatriot, said he had to Google what Twitch was. Jack Zullo said he wanted another option on my poll. He said, you need another choice. I'm aware of Twitch, and I want to start streaming content. So
okay,
he wants
to
get
to go
into Twitch.
So bye.
Okay. All right.
Thanks, Christian.
You're welcome.
I'm Alan Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.